Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What do you want first, the bad news about the housing market or the bad news about fixing the housing market? Because we got both today, you know. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and why fixing them might take a little while. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Yellow Book 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this Tuesday, everybody. It is the 17th of August. All right, so we're going to take this in order. First, the bad news about the actual housing market. Although builders broke ground on slightly more new homes in July than they did the month before, they are clearly not so optimistic about next month. They filed fewer permits for future construction. That number, future permits, is down to a 14-month low. In Washington, meanwhile, the news was of the financing of the housing market. Folks from the Treasury Department, some big banks, and a bunch of academic economists were all talking about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They, as you might remember, are the big mortgage companies that were so dysfunctional the government took them over 2 years ago. Together, they owe taxpayers around $150 billion. Pretty much everybody agrees they need to be fixed. But there's a problem with that. It is called the American economy. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
Fannie and Freddie got into trouble during the housing bubble, buying up and repackaging dicey home loans that turned sour. Since being taken over and bailed out by the government 2 years ago, they've gotten religion. They've tightened lending standards, and their portfolios of new loans are actually performing pretty well. And now, says Guy Sakala, publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance, they're more important than ever.
Upwards of 90% of all mortgages being made now carry some sort of government insurance.
Private investors have all but vanished from the secondary mortgage market, a crucial link that frees up money so banks can make fresh loans to home buyers. And most of that slack has been taken up by Fannie and Freddie.
The housing market is still on federal life support. It's very tough to talk about pulling the plug on somebody who's basically keeping it alive.
Republicans and free market economists say we can't afford to leave these government-owned mortgage giants plugged in anymore. They want to gradually wind them down. They're worried about adding to the mounting federal deficit by guaranteeing Fannie and Freddie's future losses indefinitely. And they think the private sector would do a better job of financing the housing industry long term. But curtailing the role of Fannie and Freddie right away could set the economy way back, says Wharton economist Susan Wachter. She was on the panel at the Washington Housing Summit today.
Without them, without the government support at this point, we would be in a serious recession again. A double dip for sure.
One result, economists say, would likely be higher interest rates to cover the increased investment risk on mortgages not backed by the government, which in turn would lead to falling home sales and another round of job losses in construction, real estate, and home improvement. In the short run, says Columbia University economist Christopher Mayer, there's nothing to do but keep propping up housing with every available tool, from low interest rates to Fannie and Freddie's 90% lock on the mortgage market.
The time to get rid of these things is not in the middle of a major housing crunch, because everyone understands that we can't risk our nascent recovery turning south.
If we did start to fiddle, Mayer predicts, the consequences could be disastrous, starting with another 10% drop in home prices.
We would see banks on the verge of failure again, and we would see Fannie and Freddie with hundreds of billions more in losses.
Of course, it's exactly that risk to U.S. taxpayers of huge future losses on government-backed mortgages adding to a swelling federal deficit that's driving the debate about Fannie and Freddie. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, corporate profits, a big merger offer, and bang, it's the happy music. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Education Secretary Arne Duncan has waded into a controversy that's brewing out here in Los Angeles. This week, the Los Angeles Times published a story about the effectiveness of public school teachers here. It singled out a couple whose students have been falling behind, and the paper eventually plans to publish a database that rates thousands of teachers by name according to how well they improve student test scores. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Maryland, Amy Scott reports.
Helene Solomon teaches fifth grade at Bright Elementary in Los Angeles. She says it's been a tough year.
We spent a year with pink slips flying all over the place, not knowing who was going to be teaching here next year, and all of us taking a pay cut.
And now this. Later this month, the LA Times will publish what amounts to performance reviews on more than 6,000 elementary teachers. They'll be ranked based on whether they improve student test scores in math and reading. Solomon hasn't seen her score, but she expects she'll fall somewhere in the middle, and she doesn't think that's fair.
My educational program is so much more than just the test. I'm not teaching to the test. So I'm giving the children all these variety of experiences that never get tested.
Solomon says many factors affect how well her students do on tests: parent participation, whether they have computers at home.
This has the odor about it of naming and shaming.
Diane Ravitch was assistant education secretary under the first President Bush. She wrote The Death and Life of the Great American School System. Ravitch says labeling the best and worst teachers could make a mess for schools.
It's going to create dissension on school staffs. It's going to have parents say, I want my kid in the class of those who are in the top 10%. And I don't know how you squeeze 100% of the kids into the classes of 10% of the teachers.
Education Secretary Arnie Duncan told the LA Times he thinks this information can help schools identify successful teachers and reward them. Kate Walsh is president of the National Council on Teacher Quality.
The system we have now in place is patently unfair to teachers because good teachers get paid the same as the worst teachers in the school. And there is nothing more demoralizing than having that happen.
Except maybe having your performance ranked in the local paper. Walsh says test scores shouldn't be the only measure of a teacher's value. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There is a certain set of not-so-secret code words that corporate America uses to let people know what's really going on with them. American Apparel, the once hip but now deeply troubled clothing company, used two of them today. First of all, it released what are called preliminary earnings, giving Wall Street analysts a sneak peek at the official bad news yet to come. And then in that earnings announcement, it said there is some doubt that it can continue as a going concern. They might as well have said they've got the bankruptcy papers all but signed, because that's what usually follows news of not being a going concern. The company is expected to lose as much as $7 million in the second quarter. Sales have been dropping for a year. And it's not that the market for striped tights and silver lamé jumpsuits has dried up. Stacey Vanek Smith reports this is a case of a company whose eyes were a whole lot bigger than its stomach.
It's been a hard couple of years for retailers, but for American Apparel, it's been really hard. Sales have been dropping roughly 10% a month, it's millions of dollars in debt, and it's come under attack for everything from Lolita-esque ad campaigns to hiring illegal workers to its wildcard CEO, who once told the Wall Street Journal his company's chief financial officer was a complete loser.
It's never been a really professionally run business. It's kind of been run as a game.
That's retail analyst George Whalen. He says American Apparel thrived for years because of its edgy fashions, cool anti-establishment reputation, and good press for making its clothes in the U.S. But that last part meant the company's expenses were a lot higher.
The concept of making and selling American-made clothes is a very good one, but you have to have a well-run organization to do it. If your costs are higher, you've got to do other things to be better.
Which American Apparel didn't. Even when the economy tanked, the company wouldn't cut its spending. Just last year, it opened more than a dozen stores. Now retail consultant Andrew Jassen sees just one option.
It looks like a company that needs the help of the courts in a bankruptcy.
Jassen doubts we've seen the last of the brand. He says American Apparel's appeal is still strong.
Perhaps a deal taking the name American Apparel and parking it in another retailer, such as Target or Walmart.
Or Jassen says a private buyer could take over the company, but a bankruptcy would probably have to happen first. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
There are days when what a news story really means can take a while to sink in. Today was one of them. This morning, an Australian company, out of the blue, completely unsolicited, offered $39 billion to buy the world's largest fertilizer producer. Kind of an interesting but so what in the grand scheme of things story, until you remember recent developments in commodity prices, as in they're going up because supplies are going down, wheat in particular, but corn and soybeans too. The fertilizer company is holding out, thanks but no thanks to your $39 billion, they said. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains why there is fertile ground for future profits.
Australian mining company BHP Billiton wants to invest in Canada. Potash Corp. of Saskatchewan is the world's largest fertilizer producer. And Standard & Poor's equity analyst Richard O'Reilly says potash is a scarce resource, not available in many places.
The only other producers are located in Germany and Russia and Ukraine. So there's a limited number of producers. And being the world's largest, it gives a company like BHP entry into the industry in a large scale.
O'Reilly says operating on a large scale would allow the company to meet the demands of a wealthier and more populous world.
The growing middle class in emerging countries like China and India, this requires a higher standard of living, a higher requirement for protein, meats, and requires a greater farm output in terms of grains.
More food requires more fertilizer, says Edlin Rodriguez, an analyst with Gleacher & Company.
One of the few ways that you can increase food production is through better fertilization. I mean, you have to use more fertilizers.
He says companies from other industries are attracted by the potential profits.
Outsiders like the big mining companies are definitely interested.
It seems mining companies recognize a gold mine when they see one. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Bobby Thompson died last night. If you know your baseball history, or even if you don't, you might know that Thompson hit one of the, maybe the most famous home runs in the history of the game. The shot heard around the world, New York Giants over the Brooklyn Dodgers to win the 1951 National League pennant. It made Thompson a household name. He said, in fact, that that one swing of the bat changed his life. Bobby Thompson was a modest man, but sports stars nowadays are a bit more calculating with their reputations. A trend, says Michael Weinreb in his new book, Bigger Than the Game, that started about 25 years ago. Michael Weinreb, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Where'd you get this notion that the 80s were the turning point in the economics and the business of sports?
I kind of have this vivid memory of January 1st, 1986, watching the Orange Bowl between Penn State and Oklahoma. I was a big Penn State fan, and I just remember seeing this guy on the other team named Brian Bosworth. He had an earring, and he was, you know, barking and screaming through the whole game. And I kind of traced back that memory to look at the bigger picture of what was going on in sports back then, and just the fact that sports marketing was in its infancy, and that people like Brian Bosworth were really creating an image for themselves because they realized that that image would sell.
What about sports before Boz and you know, the mid-1980s? I mean, it's not like athletes weren't image conscious before this.
Sure, they all had, you know, guys had shoe contracts, or, you know, you had O.J. Simpson doing the rental car commercials. But it really hit a new level once you got to this point in the 80s. You had the growth of two huge conglomerates in ESPN and Nike at the same time. ESPN just giving these guys more exposure, just changing the way that we were able to see them and changing the way that they kind of saw themselves. Then you have Nike, which is just able to create personalities. You know, they did it with Jordan first, and then later on they did it with Bo Jackson, where they were just able to create these incredible ad campaigns where these guys essentially became almost mythological figures.
Yeah, but let me ask you this, though. If you take it to the opposite chronological end of your analysis and you bring it to the present day, if you start with the thesis that these athletes were consciously marketing themselves and trying to build themselves up, and now today you have guys like LeBron James and the whole ESPN, I'm going to Miami thing, and you have Tiger Woods imploding, doesn't sound like anybody's learned the lesson.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, they create such a cocoon around themselves that when we do get some sort of small glimpse of who they really are, and if it's not a flattering glimpse of who they really are, then the backlash is unbelievable, because that's just the that's the repercussions for them, you know, kind of creating this image for themselves and being so careful about their brand and how they're recognized and how they're used in commercials.
Did you reach out to ESPN and Nike in particular and ask them how they feel about what they have helped bring about?
Yeah, well, I'm actually a contributor to ESPN, so there's a little
well, for now,
little
anyway,
bit,
right?
Yeah, exactly. It might not last after this. But, you know, I mean, I think a lot of it happened a long time ago, too. I did talk to a couple people at Nike, and I talked to Jim Riswald, who's the guy who created those ad campaigns. He really basically said, you know, I created a monster. And now when he sees these ads for, you know, these LeBron James ads or any of the other ones, they just seem like pale imitations to him. For Nike now, Nike is such a huge conglomerate. Same with ESPN. They're such a huge conglomerate that it's hard for them to sort of be that snappy underdog that they were at the beginning.
Yeah, so here's the value judgment question. Good for sport, you know, capital S, or bad?
Good for athletes. Good for
which is not necessarily the same thing.
Not necessarily good for fans. I think as a fan, you get addicted to all this exposure and television and just the sheer number of games and the sheer number of all the talk and all everything that's out there now. It's hard to disconnect yourself. So we're probably as responsible as anybody else as fans for this growth as well.
Michael Weinreb. His book is called Bigger Than the Game, the 1980s as a turning point in professional sports in this country. Michael, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up, when moratorium means more questions than answers.
The rig hands on the rig. One of the things they always want to know is where they're going to be working tomorrow.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials broke a 5-day losing streak today, cranked up 103 points, 1%, closed at 10,405, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ jumped 1.25%, 27 points, 2209 at the bell. The S&P 500 powered up 1.33%, 14 points, finished at 1,094. Strong earnings from Walmart and Home Depot helped drive the markets higher. Walmart shelved the gain of 1.2%. Home Depot hammered up more than 3% today. Talked about potash earlier. Potash Corporation of Saskatchewan steamed up 27%. That on news that it rejected the takeover bid from BHP Billiton. BHT dug down 2.4%. Financials had kind of a mixed day. Goldman Sachs and Bank of America ended the day up less than 1%. J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup both lost 0.5%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.63%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at Vanguard.com. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. President Obama is scheduled to talk to families and community members about the economy in Columbus, Ohio. He then heads to Florida for a fundraiser. The second International Swine Flu Conference convenes in Washington. And Timothy Geithner is in the news because it's his birthday. He'll be 49. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down. and write myself a letter.
We open our letters segment this week with the cancer charity Susan G. Komen for the Cure. Our story about the group last week had you racing to write in. The charity is suing other nonprofits that use the phrase for the cure. Kayaks for the cure, kites for the cure, you get the point. A point, though, not appreciated by Havertown, Pennsylvania's Tina Woods and a whole lot of the rest of you, too.
It sounds like the branding campaign is overshadowing the original mission to eradicate breast cancer. Maybe there is such a thing as too big to care when a charity has sufficient resources and time to include legal harassment of smaller charities for less common causes as a fundraising strategy.
Google's fundraising strategies have gotten a good deal of coverage lately. It's come to an agreement with Verizon on ways to charge different prices for different kinds of content online. The other day, I did an interview with a Wall Street Journal reporter about how Google's using data from our searches and emails to send more relevant ads our way. Most of you hated that idea. Just too invasive, you said. Brian Kinnear from Hillsboro, Oregon, thought not.
Considering that Google provides free email and free search and free maps, it's hard to argue that trying to make a profit on the data that they collect is evil.
Another story on sketchy profits, Zimbabwe this time. The country makes loads in the diamond trade, but a lot of the gems would be classified as conflict diamonds if not for a loophole. And that story struck a very personal chord with new bride Riley Curran of Chelsea, Michigan.
This is exactly why I didn't want a diamond engagement ring. I got a kayak instead, and I love it. Some people don't get it, but after hearing stories like this, how could any woman feel good about wearing diamonds? We got married this weekend, and I definitely feel good about kayaking with my husband.
Finally today, oh my goodness, beer. I probably should have figured that we would get some heartfelt responses to my trip down to the Stone Brewing Company yesterday. There were a lot of tweets and emails about it. We will let this from Kirk Vogel in Charlotte, North Carolina, stand as a representative sample. European beer, mostly thin, watery lagers, he wrote. That is the single most idiotic statement I have ever heard on public radio. Do some research. What's next? You'll introduce pasta in Italy? First of all, that is not the single stupidest thing ever. I happen to know I'm in public radio. But anyway, there were a good number of fans of that story. But just to show you that we are equal opportunity offenders here at Marketplace, our senior editor, Patty Hirsch, heard the show on the bus on his way home, sent this note.
Thin watery lagers. It seems it's high time I took you down to Roy Clayton's pub and poured you full of pints of old speckled hen.
So I will just say this, and then we're going to have to agree to disagree. Beer is subjective. One person's fizzy yellow stuff is another person's beer of choice, and that's kind of the beauty of it, isn't it? Whatever your favorite beverage, and if it happens to be beer, we got some good listener suggestions yesterday. You might want to check them out. But whatever it is, write to us. Go to marketplace.org. Click on that link in the top right corner. It's the one that says contact. It's going to be a while before there's a final decision on the Obama administration's oil drilling moratorium. An appellate ruling yesterday means a lower court judge basically has to go back to the drawing board on the whole thing. The White House imposed the drilling ban almost 3 months ago. The judge threw it out. The White House came back with another one. Meanwhile, people and businesses along the Gulf Coast are along for the ride. Drill, don't drill, make money, don't make money. From Red River Radio, Kate Archer Kent reports.
Oil is king in Lafayette. About one out of every three jobs here is tied to it. And downtown is called Oil Center because of the number of energy companies clustered there. One of them is Stokes and Spieler, which, among other services, provides drilling supervisors for offshore rigs. Since the moratorium, the company has idled nearly a quarter of its 200 supervisors. The Obama administration says the temporary drilling ban is a necessary safety precaution, but the order has been challenged in federal court. Bruce Jordan is president of Stokes and Spieler.
We were enjoying a steady increase in business, and now we have to battle the government to continue to have a business.
Even though the ban only affects deepwater rigs, Jordan has seen much of his shallow water business dry up, too. Since the BP spill, the Interior Department has revamped safety requirements for all drilling operations, and only two shallow water permits have been approved. 10 are pending. But even before the spill, shallow water drilling in the Gulf was in decline because most of the available oil has already been extracted. Jordan says he's now shifting his company's focus away from the Gulf altogether and looking for work in the oil fields of South Texas.
The rig hands on the rig, one of the things they always want to know is where they're going to be working tomorrow. And when you don't know, it concerns everyone.
Still, for some companies, the moratorium has provided a boost in business. M&H Energy Services designs and inspects drilling platforms. Alan Latour is a salesman at the company's Lafayette office. He says M&H has hired extra engineers to help drillers comply with new federal safety regulations.
Companies are contacting us to make sure their drawings, their documentation is in order. So initially it's going to help us out with companies panicking over what kind of documentation they need.
But Latour worries deepwater drilling will be slow to rebound once the moratorium is lifted. He says many independent drillers are looking to move their rigs to other countries.
The rest of the world's not on a moratorium to drill. The rest of the world's trying to get our rigs, our personnel.
Meantime, some Lafayette businesses are trying to take the moratorium in stride. In a sprawling open-air machine shop, a welder pounds out an iron drilling tool. Frank's Casing Crew and Rental Tools got its start during the Great Depression. Today, Frank's employs more than 600 people. Jonathan Ossolet is the head of new product delivery. He says there hasn't been a single layoff, even though 40% of Frank's revenue is tied to Gulf drilling. Ossolet says given the boom and bust nature of the oil services business, companies have to be prepared not to make money for 3 years straight.
Frank's has the resources it needs to survive for quite a while. We're in this for the long haul.
Frank set an industry record for making the longest well pipe on an ExxonMobil rig in the Gulf. Ossolet says the company is ready to do more deepwater work once the drilling ban is over.
We don't feel like drilling is an either or. You know, it's not the environment or it's not drilling. We can do both. So that's why people here are really anxious to get back, because we know that we can be successful doing both. And we can get our part of the country and our earnings back into position economically.
The state of Texas is the latest plaintiff to file suit against the moratorium, but no court date has been set. Other legal challenges are also pending. In Lafayette, Louisiana, I'm Kate Archer-Kent for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which we learn that maybe the government was just tad over-optimistic when it said most of the leaked oil in the Gulf of Mexico had magically disappeared. That was a couple of weeks ago. The feds said only 26% of the oil was still there. The rest had been burned, skimmed, or dispersed, naturally or chemically. Researchers at the University of Georgia beg to differ. Marine scientists there say almost 80% of the oil still is in the Gulf. It's just down deep where nobody can see it. And on this Tuesday, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 103 points, about 1%. The NASDAQ jumped 27 points, 1.25%. The S&P 500 put on 14 points, about 1.33%. Thanks to Rod Abid and Ethan Lindsay on our Morning Report crew. And that is where you can tune tomorrow for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, the modern-day colonoscopy and the business of prevention.
The thought was, well, if looking at part of the colon is good, looking at the entire colon must be better.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.